Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Carl from ISF and Filmanson Stuff, and we're here doing a special Carl's Cavern on the films and TV work of the great Larry Cohen. And with me, it's really nice to welcome back a good friend to the podcast, Patrick Crane. Patrick, nice to have you with us again. It's been a while, my friend.
Oh yes, it's been very, very busy since the turn of the calendar, and but I'm very, very, very glad to be here with you and talking about Larry Cohen, who I absolutely love. So thank you for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. So tell me how you first got introduced to Larry Cohen, and then I'll tell you how I did.
Larry Cohen was a director who was sort of on the very, you know, outer boundaries of the fringes of the filmmakers that I was into when I was first getting into genre cinema in the early 80s and through mid 80s. At that point, I think the only thing I knew of his was Q and The Stuff. And then later in the 80s, I came across It's Alive and It Lives Again. But where he grabbed me as a filmmaker was when I first saw God Told Me To, which was Anchor Bay did a very nice re-release on VHS in the early 90s of God Told Me To. And whenever I feast my eyes upon that movie, I was like, I've got to see everything this guy's made.
And that's how it started with you. For me, it goes back further than that. I was a kid in the 60s, and I loved science fiction and was a big fan of The Twilight Zone and Outer Limits and such, even being only 6 years old at the time. But in the mid-60s, of course, the Invaders came. And that was really, really a big one for me. And at the time, I didn't know who Larry Cohen was. I didn't realize it. I wasn't looking at anything, you know, at the credits or anything. But then in the summer of 67, I ran across this summer program, which I started right at the beginning and went right to the end. And then when summer was over, I was really pissed that it wasn't picked up. I think it was the first program that I got literally angry that TV didn't pick up for a second season. And that's continued for me for many years. That would be Coronet Blue. And that series I just got hooked on that thing. And I know that you just watched that. You did an essay on it. So tell me what you thought of Coronet Blue.
Oh, I really, I loved Coronet Blue. I thought that was a really clever show. I knew of the premise when I picked it up. Of course, it predates me, it being on the air a good 6 years before I was born. But, the premise obviously intrigues me because it's the Bourne identity, really. It's a guy who gets shot and tossed over the side of a boat by some shadowy figures, and he survives, but his memory is gone. The only thing he can remember are the two words Coronet Blue, and the show is him trying to figure out what those two words mean and who he is. And throughout the show, you see him, you know, you realize he knows how to do martial arts and stuff, and these things that are kind of second nature to him. So I'm like really stunned that somehow Larry Cohen didn't sue Robert Ludlum when he wrote The Bourne Identity in 1980, because they are so strikingly similar in everything. And the show was just really, really great. It has a structure that's very much like a Western. The guy comes into town, you know, there's some element that draws him to the town that has to do with his past. Possibly he gets mixed up in some kind of local, you know, fracas, and then he saves the day and has to move on to another town for some reason. Very kind of Incredible Hulk-like. And the show only lasted 13 episodes. Like you said, it wasn't picked back up, but that had more to do with the lead's contract with CBS. It ran out, and they couldn't get him back. That was the problem. And so the show folded. And that's such a shame, because it's got a kind of a feeling of The Prisoner a little bit, the British show, just in the kind of the conspiracy elements and the kind of insular kind of world that it portrays. And it's got kind of the mix of the look of Mission Impossible, which, you know, of course, is just because of the time. But it's just it's a wonderful show, and it's out there on DVD. Kino Lorber did a nice set of it, and it's really worth picking up. It's a great show.
I also think it had a lot of his shows, the Invaders and Cordette Bleu, and a couple others that he did. Griff was another one. I had elements of The Fugitive to me too. That he's being hunted and he has to escape and he has to keep safe all the while trying to figure out who he is and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of elements there. It's a really good show. So we go on into his filmography, and there are, you know, definite high points. And I guess the first one, I think, that we need to talk about is his debut film that he directed. Now, we'll get back to some of the other things he did, too, previous to that. But have you seen Bone, and what do you think of Bone?
Oh, yeah, I've seen Bone, and Bone is one of my favorite Larry Cohen movies. It's absolutely scorching. It's brilliant. He made nothing else quite like it in his career, and that has a lot to do with it was not marketable. It is such an oddity, and I'm just in love with that movie. It's almost like an exploitation riff on Cassavetes' Faces a little bit. Unfortunately, it's kind of like a seriously made film for drive-ins and grindhouses. That's not really the kind of audience that it needed. Yaphet Kotto and Jeannie Berlin are great, but my God, Joyce Van Patten, that performance deserves, that's one of the great unsung performances of the 70s. Joyce Van Patten in that movie is just absolutely incredible, on fire. And it's such a movie, it's for rediscovery, because all of the themes in it are still so relevant: class and race and gender and the sexual politics. Mm-hmm. There's just not really quite like a movie like Bone, certainly not in Larry Cohen's filmography, but not in a whole lot of films of the 70s. It's wholly unique, and I would urge everybody to go out and find Bone. If any of the movies that we talk about, you know, there are other ones that are more fun, and there may be even, I don't think Bone is his best film, but it's the one that I think everybody should really go and see, because you will really be blown away by Bone.
Well, it's unlike anything else. I mean, you talk about Joyce Van Patten. I've always thought that a Woman Under the Influence, you talked about Cassavetes. I'm thinking, you know, Bone came before that. Bone is 1972, and Woman Under the Influence is 74. And I'm thinking Tanner Rollins took a look at Joyce Van Patten and said, "Yeah, I'm going to go that far." Seriously.
Yeah, right.
I really think that. And let's not forget Andrew Duggan in that either. He's really good in it too. Those car commercials that become sort of like a way of seeing how his mind is going and going and going and how he's going over the edge. is really good. It's a skating film, and you know that they didn't know what the hell to do with it, because look at the titles they tried to market it under. Dial Rat for Terror.
Housewife is the other one. We planned to screen this movie last month down in Film Row, and we got preempted by weather. But that was the thing that I put on the promotional thing was the three different posters this movie had and how different each one looks. It's amazing that they, and none of them really, I love the original poster, but it doesn't tell you anything, which doesn't bother me. But from a promotional standpoint, none of the posters really convey what is going on in Bone. Because it's like a suburban nightmare like no other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's all about class and upper class and lower class and all these things that actually remind me of like the maids of all things. Seriously, Jean Genet.
Right.
And we're talking like heady film people here, but damn it, that's about what you have to do with this thing, because it's like this combination of low rent style and high ended ideas that, you know, don't think that you can mix them, but they do and it works. But how the hell do you market them better?
Yep.
Seriously.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the problem they faced. And you know, and that's just such a shame that it never did find the audience in its day. Because again, I think had Bone been a critical and commercial hit, Larry Cohen's career may have gone in a markedly different path. Now, I'm not sad that it went the way that it did, but Bone again is just a very different movie. It's not like anything else in his filmography. The ideas that are in Bone carry over, but in terms of being specifically set in that, you know, without any kind of action element, without any kind of thriller element, Bone is just, it could be a play in some form or fashion, because it does stay confined a lot of times to a central location. And it's really just about the performances and about the writing, and also, very cleverly edited. And, I can't say they're just not enough superlatives for Bone.
You know, the one thing is, yes, his career could have gone differently, but in many ways, I'm glad it went the way it did, because the one thing that Bone showed was that he was an egalitarian director, and particularly of actors. And we talk about Yaphet Kotto. And so his next film is Black Caesar, which is one of the greatest blaxploitation films ever made. Seriously. That thing is beautiful. And he decided to do the James Cagney thing, but only with Fred the Hammer Williamson, and man, that was the film. I remember we seen that on HBO in the mid 70s and just like blown away, thinking it's as good as Shaft, as good as Superfly, and I mean, personally, I think it is. I think it's one of the top five ever done as far as blaxploitation. And what's your thoughts on Black Caesar?
Oh, I agree. I think it's just absolute dynamite. I love that it's kind of an update of the, you know, it was the like kind of then most conventional elements of the gangster film. It was coming off the success of Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song.
Right.
And, I thought it's just very smart, incredibly written. The violence is pretty shocking. I love all the stolen shots. The action is incredible. That fucking, where he falls out of the taxi, that whole sequence, I was, I, you know, you catch your breath because you can tell that this stuff is done on the fly and it's raw and it's gritty. You know, mm-hmm. I think Scarface, the Brian De Palma film, owes as much to Black Caesar as it does the Howard Hawks original. That massacre outside of Larry Cohen's house, which Larry Cohen's house right. always pops up in Larry Cohen's movies. But were they encroach upon the house and go off the roof and massacre all the mobsters out by the pool? And that's incredible. A guy actually legit falls off the roof of the house into some bushes, and it looks like it hurt like a son of a bitch. But, you know, Larry Cohen, he didn't give a shit. He just, you know, he just made people go and go and go. And it's just so much fun. It's a blast.
Oh, absolutely.
And that James Brown score, that James Brown score is incredible.
I mean, when I look at blaxploitation films, and I give you my top five, it's always like number two or number three for me. Never below number three, ever. You know, and that changes day by day. But so there's a story. So he does Black Caesar, and the studios love him, and say, well, we want a sequel to Black Caesar. Huh? We want a sequel to Black Caesar. He's dead. We want a sequel to Black Caesar. He's fucking dead. No, he's not. We want a sequel. Oh, fuck you. I'll do it. And that's basically what happened to Hell Up in Harlem, which unfortunately is more than a couple steps down. But that's because his heart wasn't in it, in that particular film. There's still a couple of good set pieces in Hell up in Harlem, but you could tell that Cohen was doing it just because he had to. Would you agree with that assessment?
I think it's a step down, but I'm still a pretty big fan of Hell Up in Harlem. I think it's got, again, I think it's got some incredible set pieces. I love how he retcons the end of Black Caesar to make it happen. It's got an incredible energy when they rush him into the hospital. They actually break the window of that's in a door when they throw it open. And so, you know, it's all of those kinds of things that I love. I love that it takes about, you know, 20-30 minutes to actually set the movie up. And then it becomes kind of a Carlito's Way, back to Brian De Palma, where, you know, the character sort of attempts a redemption arc in this film. And, you know, his new love affair versus his old one, that's a, you know, unexpected layer of depth that I like. You know, the chase in down Times Square at night is really good, and her murder I thought was really kind of shocking. And that ending, that cross-country chase that starts in New York and ends in LAX is amazing. All of those stolen shots and all of those, I mean, that is epic. You know, they actually chase each other across the country. I love it. So, I mean, you know, it may be a step down. It's not as monumental as Black Caesar, but I still think it's a whole lot of fun. And in terms of the kind of, because it's one of the early sequels in terms of the sequel cycle that we started seeing in the 70s, you know, with The Godfather, The Godfather 2, you know, French Connection 2, Jaws 2, so, and some of those early sequels where they're still trying to figure out, do we just repeat the formula? Do we really try to find a way to expand the story? You know, I think when you look at it in terms of those movies that came out specifically in the 70s, I think Hell Up in Harlem is one of the better ones, actually. And I really do dig it. But I agree.
Okay, I haven't
stepped down from Black Caesar.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in years, so I have to revisit. So I didn't get a chance to see it for this podcast. But I remember seeing it on HBO, and then seeing it in a repertory theater in the 80s. And just didn't think it was nearly as good. I'll have to reassess it at this point. So now we get to It's Alive. And one of the things now that becomes very apparent with Larry is his point of view and his satiric look at specific problems. And It's Alive, I was born with a birth defect. And I take a look at this movie, and it still shakes me up, this film. And, you know, you've got the special effects by Rick Baker. When it first came out, it was panned, but then he said, let's do a different PR and poster. And so because of that, and because of that epic poster with the claw coming out of the baby carriage, it became quite a hit. And, of course, there are two sequels to it. So your thoughts on It's Alive?
Oh, It's Alive is one of his absolute best films. I love that he kind of beats David Lynch and David Cronenberg to the punch his mutant baby. You know, his mutant baby, Opus, which is kind of really his commentary on, then-nascent anxieties about, pollution and abortion and the emergence of psychoanalysis and our familial roles and all that kind of shit. And I love how Larry Cohen sets up this very beautiful all-American family with John P. Ryan and Sharon Farrell, and they are just terrific in their roles. Especially John P. Ryan, who just acts his fucking heart out in this movie. I mean, like, he is so good in this movie. It's just devastating to watch their family disintegrate as the situation gets worse. Because, yeah, he just sets them up so beautifully and takes his time before he just absolutely destroys them. And, the Rick Baker effects are great. Of course, the Bernard Ehrman score is one of his last, and it's a great one. And I just think that It's Alive is a fine piece of suburban horror and one of the great unsung monster films of its day. And its strategy of not showing the baby predates Jaws. Mm-hmm. Not showing, keeping the monster hidden as much as possible. You never know where it is. A lot of times, it's nearby. That's a brilliant strategy that you might make a case that Spielberg might have, ate that a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing too is I love the photographic effects in it. When you're seeing things from the baby's distorted viewpoint, that just makes it even creepier. But the scene that really got me in that film, it's not the horror, in terms of the slaughter, and there's enough of that in it. But it's the scene where the police are tracking the baby, and they find it, and they surround the baby with loaded guns, and it's a normal baby.
That's a great scene.
Yeah, it's really his. You can see his satiric version of U.S. and that from this point on throughout his filmography. He certainly played with it in Bone, but from here on in, it's pure. Let's get out the satiric knives and just destroy. American civilization as I go through this. It's beautiful. And of course, as we go on, you see more and more overt humor from him, too. This one is not. This one is not funny. I mean, you get to It's Alive 3, which, by the way, I fucking love, okay, even though it's silly as hell.
Yeah,
I adore that movie.
We'll get to that, sure. Me too.
Yeah. Okay, then we were talking a little bit about this before, but when I first saw God Told Me To, I was working at a drive-in and working with quotes, but nonetheless. And saw it under the name of Demon. Had no idea what it was. But by this time, I knew who Larry Cohen was. And when it came up and it was written and directed by Larry Cohen, I said, don't bother me, Howard. I'm watching this fucking film, and I don't care what. Oh, my God, I love this film. And one of the reasons I love it, and this is one of the things that he did throughout his filmography, he took older actors that were more famous back in the 40s and 50s and gave them chances to act. Now, here we have Tony LoBianco, and of course, you know, I don't know if you know this, but Robert Forster was actually cast first, but he and Cohen had arguments, so he was fired. They got Tony LoBianco. They got Sandy Dennis, who I just adore. But then the person that really got me in this film was Sylvia Sidney. And that whole scene with LoBianco and Sidney is just unbelievable. But this is, how the hell do you describe this thing? You want to give it a shot?
Oh, sure. I called it a genius stew of urban panic, Catholic guilt, conspiracy theories, cult, abortion, alien beings, and Jesus Christ.
And Richard Lynch.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, there's nothing like God Told Me To. And I'll tell you, when I first saw it, there was a video guide that really raved about it and said that it truly was kind of the proto X-Files. I mean, like, you know, it's sort of like the ground zero for that kind of thing, but really the Norlis tapes probably would be. Of course, I don't know when the Norlis tapes were done. Probably
it was a little before
around
this. Norlis was 73. Norlis was 73.
Okay,
so this is 74. Or 75, actually.
This 76.
Okay.
But yeah, it's just, you know, the thing about it is despite everything about it, despite its sort of lurid drive-in appeal, or its, you know, kind of grindhouse origins, it's a truly serious look at faith. And it's just, it's a rare film that you could double bill with Bad Lieutenant. You could double bill it with Mean Streets. You could double bill it with John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness. I mean, it's an ambitious, one-of-a-kind masterpiece. I think that it truly is Larry Cohen's best film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot to it. One of the things is of course, the setup is that people are killing each other and snipers and that, and why are they doing God Told Me To? And of course you've got LoBianco as a lapsed Catholic who's trying to deal with his faith. And of course his wife is very faithful, ex-wife is very faithful, played by Sandy Dennis. And then his girlfriend, Deborah Raffin. But you have all of that going on. And you have this police procedural. You have a number of things happening that you don't really understand. And even at the end of the movie, you're like saying, huh? What? Wait, what did I miss? And this is the type of film I think you need to watch two or three times to really catch some stuff. But you know, if you go through it once and you're confused, you're like, you want to find out. You want to go back and figure out all the clues. And I think that's beautiful. And unfortunately, of course, a lot of people and reviewers at the time just shook up their heads like, what the hell is this? But I think upon second and third viewing, it becomes apparent at how great this film is and how it raises the bar in so many ways. Not just in acting or directing, but in thought and what it's talking about and what it's trying to achieve. And it is a mishmash, man. Good Lord, everything that goes in there, you wonder how it all is going to come out. And I think that's one of the the true graces of the film. It's because it can come out in so many different ways depending on how you look at it, and it's an individual viewpoint. It doesn't coddle the audience at all. Not at all.
No. And, I just think that it's a truly head and shoulders above the kind of thing you could expect from genre cinema of its type. And that also, this film is sort of Larry Cohen distilled. He's high concept, but it's almost like he smashes two high concept ideas together in a lot of ways. He's just such a creative filmmaker, and there are so many different kinds of avenues in his filmmaking and in his films. And I that's the thing I love so much about this film is it's impossible for me to tell you what this is. Just sit here and watch it. It reminds me a little bit of Jeff Lieberman's Blue Sunshine is another one kind of like that, where it's almost impossible for me to describe this movie to you. You just have to watch it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love Blue Sunshine. We've had Jeff on a couple of times. Wonderful, wonderful film and wonderful film director. Okay, so at this point, okay, if we take a look at this particular film, God Told Me To, then things start to, with his stuff, it starts to diffuse maybe a little bit into other things and other things he's talking about. And so from here on in, I'm going to ask one question. If you were to say what his most underrated film is, what would it be?
Well, I think his most underrated film in his career is Bone. I mean, it just, because it's just not, well, I mean, I guess maybe let me take that back. I guess that's his most underseen film, or tragically underseen film. If I had to say what's one of his most underrated films, I would probably say It's Alive 3, Island of the Alive.
Let's talk about that for a second. I love that movie.
Yeah, I do too. I think that might be the best horror trilogy, like pure trilogy, there is, in my opinion. Because I love all three of those movies.
For different reasons too.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
The thing that I love about It's Alive 2, It Lives Again, is the John Ryan character and what happens to him and how he changes his whole attitude from the first film and how he becomes proactive in trying to save these particular mutants and from the government trying to kill them. And so at the end of It's Alive 2, they decide to take him out on an island. And 10 years later, he does Island of the Alive, which was, I think, a direct-to-video. I don't think it had a theatrical premiere.
Right.
But of the three, this is by far the most satiric and the most comic of the three. I mean, that whole section of him being in Cuba and that sort of thing is silly. And I love the scene where they're going to the island and he gets them drunk and starts singing Moriarty. And now we've got to talk about Michael Moriarty. Okay. If there was ever an actor director pairing that was really unique and really fucking great, it's those two. So I know you wanted to talk about that, so go for it, Patrick.
Well, I mean, this all dates back to, of course, Q, which is the movie he made in 1982. Q, the Winged Serpent.
Yeah.
Because after he does God Told Me To, he does The Private Files of J. Edgar Hoover, which is, it's worth mentioning a little bit, but it feels more like a Charles B. Pierce movie. I like it, but it's, It's not great. Okay, Scorsese's okay. The one thing
I have to say about Private Files, I think it's well worth watching. I think Broderick Crawford is really good, but the scene in that movie is Dan Daly masturbating to the tapes. Seriously.
Right.
That's the scene.
Yes, right. Yes. That's
a, and the other
and,
thing
and
too,
is to see...
Go ahead.
You know, Robert Park, huh?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, Robert Park says... Bobby Kennedy is
yes.
also sort of a fun, or Michael Parks. I'm sorry, Michael Parks is Bobby Kennedy is a that's a good one. So I like it. I like it too. I don't think it's great because it's because it can't help because of its budget. But anyway. That's what he did after God Told Me To. Then he did It's Alive Too. It Lives Again. then he did Full Moon High, which he doesn't even cover in that King Cohen documentary. But I kind of like Full Moon High. It's silly and it's not great, but it's got some funny stuff in it.
You got it all wrong. I love that fucking movie. I love that
Full
movie.
Moon High.
I adore that
sure.
film.
Let's talk about it. I actually think it's funnier than people give it credit for.
I think it's better than Teen Wolf by far.
Oh, I do too. Oh, yeah, for sure. It's definitely better than Teen Wolf because it leans in on its, it leans in on that what teenage werewolf movies are all about, which are about, puberty, going through change, and so so it leans into that sexual gag more than Teen Wolf does. Teen Wolf is a silly ass, teen sports movie, where Full Moon High is much more bawdy in its humor.
Oh, absolutely. And listen, any movie that cast Ed McMahon as a right wing businessman / politician is okay in my book. Seriously. Adam Arkin
right.
is
and,
fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
Adam
Arkin is really good in it. Roz Kelly's fun, but man, Kenneth Mars, he steals that fucking movie. Steals it.
I
love Kenneth Mars in that movie.
And I did ask you what you thought his most underrated film is. That's my choice. I think Full Moon High is, if not masterpiece, it's a fun, fun, fun movie, especially if you're in the right frame of mind for it. If you want silly and smart, that's silly and smart at the same time. You don't run across those too often.
Yeah, and you might be right whenever I think about it because, Full Moon High is really not given really any kind of spotlight. People don't really talk about it. And, Shout Factory did a nice Blu-ray of it just not too long ago. And again, as you said, it's better than Teen Wolf, and I totally agree that it's better than Teen Wolf. It's got a lot of Borscht Belt humor in it. It's a little, it's still a mess, but I did have a good time with it and, found it to be very entertaining, and it was better than I had sort of braced myself. So, I may agree with you that it might be one of his most underrated films, and not necessarily It's Alive 3, because It's Alive 3, which I'm trying to bring it back to It's Alive 3 and Michael Moriarty, It's Alive 3, people who have seen it love it. People who dismiss it probably haven't watched it, because It's Alive 3, as you said, is incredibly fucking smart. It's goofy, but it's really smart. All of its subtexts and all of its social pointed concerns are right on the money. But let's go back to Michael Moriarty because this is, like you said, this is the director-actor pairing that we love, and it goes back to Hugh the Winged Serpent from 1982, which is the movie that he was cast in. And this movie is absolutely tremendous, and I think this is probably my second favorite Larry Cohen movie, or I think it's his second best film, because the performances in this film by David Carradine, Richard Roundtree, and Candy Clark, they're all really good. But Michael Moriarty's performance in this film is like Academy Award level good. It's strangely good, like way, way above and beyond the Call of Duty he goes. He sinks his teeth into that role and does not let go. And anybody that sees it, I remember lending it to a friend saying, I swear to God, Michael Moriarty in this day and age could probably get an Oscar nomination for this role. Not in 1982 he couldn't, but maybe today he could. And he laughed it off, oh, yeah, whatever. And he brought it back to me and said, you know what, you're fucking right. He's awesome in that movie. And it's in the service of a monster movie that is really, really excellent. It's a hybrid of kind of a mob thriller, a police procedural, and a monster movie. And I love low-rent special effects because to release that in 1982 against the kind of bigger budget Spielbergian-type films that are out is really kind of a scrapper street move, very Larry Cohen. And I absolutely love Cue the Winged Serpent. And that was their first collaboration together. And it's just it's such a great one. What do you think of it?
I freaking love it. Now, I've got a great story about Cue. Okay. So we know about I, the Jury, and he was fired off I, the Jury, and Richard Heffron was brought in to direct it. And so he took the money that he had raised that he hadn't spent yet and decided, okay, I'm going to make another movie, went right into production on Cue, wrote the script in, I think, less than a week, pulled favors, got David Carradine, Richard Roundtree, Candy Clark. He just pulled this together, and they were shooting within 3 weeks. Okay, so he had hired Moriarty. During the shoot, he found out that Moriarty played the piano and sang these odd songs. So he actually added the whole thing that he's a pianist, and he's trying to get a job and so on and so forth. And that scene at the restaurant where he sits down and he plays the piano, and he sings that really weird song, which he wrote, by the way. Moriarty wrote that song. So if you take a look at that scene, take a look at Carradine, okay? Because if you look at him and you look very, very, and Larry kept this in, Moriarty breaks Carradine. He literally starts laughing, and he has to hold it in, and you can tell. Beautiful. Fucking beautiful.
Yeah. It's a wonderful, that's a wonderful, wonderful moment. And a movie that's just full of these little unexpected moments and surprises that are just, that's what makes Cue, I think, such a great film. It's so much more than what the poster promises. And the thing about the poster is it's a fucking great poster, first of all, with the monster wrapped around the Chrysler Building. But you get what's promised on the poster and more, because it's not just about this monster. There's a lot of subtext about, you know, the fine line between, you know, religious fervor and cult-like bloodthirsty idolatry. And I just love that the unforgiving nature of the animals in the jungle, both prehistoric and modern. It's got to be the best use of the Chrysler Building in all of cinema history. I mean, that ending, the attack on the Chrysler Building is so great. I love it's low budget, but you know, those guys were actually in those buckets shooting those bullets, and it created a panic, and they had to shut the production down for a second. They got in trouble.
Huh? Because there's a great scene in King Cohen, which is the documentary on Larry, and they're talking about John Landis, and he's talking about he's shooting a film, and he gets up in the morning and reads the paper, and you know, it's the whole thing about the fake thing, and bullets were coming down and that sort of thing, and filmmaker responsible, he just looks at it like, fucking Cohen, that has to be fucking Cohen. It really does. Yeah, seriously.
He was filming Trading Places, and he lost all of his cops for about 45 minutes. They were rushed because they thought there was a terrorist attack going on down in their Chrysler building, and because all these shell casings were, you know, raining down on the crowd below. And John Landis was like, "What the hell's going on? Where are all the police going?" That he had, you know, like quarantined off onto his own set. And so, yeah, he read about the next day, and he was like, "Of course, it's fucking Larry Cohen." So, you know, but I love that. Yeah, I love that story, and I also love that story about how he got it into production quicker than it took to get the other director, his replacement, on I, the Jury set in place to pick production back up. And I love that he beat them to the punch. And then back to that, the whole thing about the shooting off the rounds and creating a panic, Larry Cohen took out a little bit of money and took out an ad and a full page ad apologizing for the disruption that he caused downtown. But of course, that's nothing but more publicity for his film. So I get the return on taking out that ad was probably, you know, well worth it, because Q ended up being a pretty good hit for him.
Yeah, and it actually debuted the same day as I, the Jury, and just wiped it down. You know, I mean, I, the Jury, just,
I love that.
Tanked. Yeah.
And have you, seriously, I'm sure you've seen Eye of the Jury. I've actually never sat through the whole thing. I think I rented it once when I was in high school, and I just never, you know, I never did get through it. But is it of any interest?
No. No. Not at all. I mean, if you want to see something that, you know, sleazy just for sleazy's sake, that's all it is, and you could tell that the production was poorly done, and that there were problems, no question. And so, no, it's not worth it.
It's supposed to be in 3D too.
Yes, and then, of course, it wasn't. It wasn't. The other thing about Cohen, and we talked a little bit about Q, but he was always, you know, improvising, and he didn't use permits. He, you know, the whole, we talked about God Told Me To. Of course, there's that scene where with Andy Kaufman at the St. Patrick's Day parade, which, by the way, Andy Kaufman's debut in film. And he just did that whole scene without permit and without the parade even knowing what the fuck was going on. And there were guns involved in shooting.
I mean,
that's
well, and then going back to, you know, Black Caesar, when Fred Williamson is attacked in the street, that's all stolen. They just, I mean, you know, they just had somebody run up to him and he pretended to be, you know, hurt, and they just, you know, shot from, you know, all these invisible angles. They didn't have permits for any of that. I mean, it's amazing how much he got away with without any kind of permission.
You know, he was a guerrilla filmmaker. By that, I mean he didn't follow the rules. He never followed the rules. It was his own rules. He'd do whatever he wanted to do, which I think is beautiful. No,
and that's why his movies
are
all uniquely his. I mean, they all have a Larry Cohen patina on them.
Well, you know something, we'll get into it when we get to a later film. But there's somebody else I want to talk about that in many, many ways was his mentor. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But let's just talk about Moriarty one more second. And why is it that everything that Moriarty did with Cohen is just that good? I mean, you don't run across these director, actor, you know, pairings that much. Certainly you can say Scorsese and De Niro and there are other peoples too that you can certainly talk about, John Ford and John Wayne. But seriously, this particular pairing is just so oddball. Let's face it, Moriarty doesn't play normal at all. At all.
No, so, not at all.
So, and, so how, you know, what are your thoughts? What makes that this pairing so unique?
It has to be, it just has to be a matched crazy energy that they feed off of each other. I don't know. I think Larry Cohen recognizes something in Michael Moriarty that Michael Moriarty appreciates. And the recognition for, I think he gives him a wide latitude to develop his character.
Right.
Because in each one of his movies that he's in, the character is completely different in all four movies.
Yes.
But they're broad and they're wildly interesting and very particular and specific. And they feel like they have been truly worked on, you know, and crafted. And I don't know what that special weird magic is. I would equate it a little bit to maybe a little bit like John Carpenter and Kurt Russell in a way. They kind of brought out a really special energy in each other.
Yes,
exactly. But Moriarty, I'm sorry?
Yeah, exactly is what I agreed with you.
Yeah, but what Cohen specifically got from Moriarty is something else entirely, because these performances feel like they belong in bigger, like he belongs in bigger budgeted films doing, you know, bigger roles. These roles and these performances, you forget that these are just these like Larry Cohen exploitation films. He was very good with actors. You know, he brought out
best
in a lot of actors. But Michael Moriarty, there was just, I think, a freedom there that he allowed. And I think he loved that kind of working, that dangerous quality that Larry Cohen had, because you're working basically from the hip. You're working on the fly, catch as catch can, you know, because you're not prepping. Larry Cohen didn't prep for his movies. So, you know, I'm sorry?
No, I agree. I just agreed. That's all.
Yeah, so... I think Michael Moriarty's a little nutty, and I think he keyed in on that sort of nutty dangerousness in Larry Cohen, and I think he rewarded him with just nothing but great performances.
Absolutely, and the one thing about Q, the best line in Q, by far, was improvised, and Michael Moriarty just says, "I want a Nixon-like pardon," and that was improvised.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. But if we're going to talk about Michael Moriarty, we've got to go to my favorite Michael Moriarty, Larry Cohen film, which I just fucking love. And that's The Stuff. I saw this in the theater, and I actually went right back in and watched it again and paid for the second ticket. That's how much I love this movie. So what are your thoughts on The Stuff?
I was late to the party with The Stuff, and I'll tell you why, is because there was a period when I still do, love Roger Ebert. And Roger Ebert was down on The Stuff. I remember his review. He was really down on The Stuff. So I just never got anywhere near it. At that point, I'm getting into my kind of film snobbery years. And so I'm reading so a lot of these things I feel are beneath me. If Roger Ebert doesn't like it, then I kind of stay away from it. And it took me years to finally see The Stuff. And then I realized, you know, kind of like The Howling or kind of like, you know, a myriad other films that, well, Roger Ebert, I just disagree, because The Stuff is fucking incredible. And I think it's, you know, after those two movies that he did for Hemdale, Perfect Strangers and Special Effects, one of which I find better than the other, I think it's The Stuff is a, you know, a huge return. I'm sorry?
I said I love Special Effects. We'll get into that later.
Yeah, me too. So, yeah, okay. I think The Stuff, though, is a, you know, it's a big return to form. It reminds me of an expanded, remember that SNL skit, Shimmer? It's a floor wax or a dessert topping. It feels like Larry Cohen sort of expanded that out a little bit, and but also worked in a little bit of the blob with a little bit of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I mean, his satirical eye in this film is just so sharp. And I love that the stuff when they go into supermarkets, it's something that you should be wary of because it's something that's kept both in the dry aisle and in the refrigerator section. I love that that little detail in the movie. And Paul Sorvino and Danny Aiello in that movie are a fucking riot.
Sorvino has said that's his favorite role. He has said that is, and Sorvino plays this right wing radio personality, and he the whole thing about the taxis is just a brilliant a visual gag. There are visual gags all over the place, and then the takeoffs on commercials. Clara Peller and Abe Vigoda and oh my God, I fucking love that movie. I laughed so hard.
It's really funny. I also love that, you know, that a child, they pick up this kid. That feels kind of like a riff on a Spielberg kind of thing where they get a kid involved, but it's also very sharply cynical. You know, it's a sci-fi, monster B picture meets political conspiracy thriller, you know, that acts as a comment on consumerism and, you know, and our cultural rot in a B movie. I mean, I love all that. I just love that Larry Cohen can get all of that stuff into a movie. I mean, into one movie. It's incredible. It's the stuff, right? You can't get enough. Can't get enough of the stuff.
You know, I and the ending is fucking brutal. Love the ending to that.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going to give it away. But it's brutal and it's beautiful.
It is.
He really, really nails it in that film. I were to say his best satirical film, by far it's The Stuff. And it's funny,
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, I just think it's a brilliant film. And if there's a film that I recommend to anyone that's listening to this, it's The Stuff. I would start there. I would really start there. But to finish up, Michael Moriarty, we got to go to a Return to Salem's Lot. And I'm going to bring something else up, too, which I prepped you on beforehand. But let's talk about Salem's Lot. What are your thoughts on Salem's Lot? Return of.
The Return to Salem's Lot?
Yeah.
I really dug it. It started off a little shaky because it felt like a lot of it was stitched together in the editing room, and there was a lot of ADR and whatnot. I thought, there's something that happened here, but as the movie starts to unfold and reveal itself, it becomes much smarter than I thought it was going to be. It ended up winning me over quite a bit, especially once Sam Fuller comes into it. He's an absolute scream as sort of the Van Helsing character in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I love Moriarty's wise ass, foul mouthed teenage kid in the film. I thought that was a lot of fun. And, you know, there's a gag where, you know, they stick an American flag through the heart of a vampire, which I had only seen the first time in Alexander Aja's remake of The Hills Have Eyes, but sure enough, here it is in Return to Salem's Lot from 1987. So, I really dug this movie quite a bit.
One of the things I really love about this film, and this shows you his satirical sense and his sense of what's happening at the time, It is the first movie history, at least American film, that mentions AIDS by name. By name. And he definitely connects. This is the first one. This is by name. If you look at Longtime Companion, they don't say it. They don't say it in Philadelphia for sure. But no, this is the first one. I've read this on numerous occasions, and also on The Advocate too says that it's the first film to ever mention AIDS by name. And so for that, I think it's worthwhile, and that he's connecting addiction and disease to something that's happening at that point in time. This is where I take a look at Cohen, and I connect him to Romero, because both of them use horror tropes and the horror films to make social and political comment. And when you get into particularly Cohen's later material, it becomes extremely apparent, the satire and what he's really, really attacking. And you could say the same thing about Romero. The other connection I want to mention, and you talked about Sam Fuller. Sam Fuller, the way that he did his films. And the one line I love in Return to Salem's Lot. Oh, are you a vampire hunter? No, I'm a fucking Nazi hunter. You know, I mean, it's just so good. And Cohen and Fuller, I have always considered Cohen to be Fuller's protege. Very, very much, because they knew each other before Salem's Lot quite a bit. And so I've always made that connection. But you take a look at both Romero and Fuller, and you see this combination coming out of Cohen. And, you know, and you're talking about three of my favorite American directors, genre directors. You know, and there's a definite patronage, I think, in each of them, at least connection. Would you agree with that, Pat?
Absolutely. Yeah, because as you say, I mean, all of Romero's films are nothing but social commentaries of some sort. You know, Romero's seem to be usually more of attacks on or satirical looks at, you know, more traditional or conventional American things that don't work much anymore. Family, religion, you know, capitalism, you know, these types of things. Cohen's seems much more topical of their day. But they still come off as timeless, right? Because whatever the stuff, you know, which was specifically about basically how yogurt, there was a yogurt craze. And in fact, yogurt has bacteria in it. It'll eat something inside of you. And so that's the idea of the stuff. There was a yogurt craze. But what he ends up doing is making this, you know, this treatise on, you know, consumerism and products and corporate evil, and then throws in a little bit of right-wing militias right-wing AM radio, talk radio stations and all this stuff. I mean, everything is very, you know, topical and of its day, but it ends up making, broader statements that do actually end up being timeless. But yes, I think of all of them, Larry Cohen and George Romero are probably the most pointed in their social commentary, where I think Toby Hooper, there's some social commentary there, but it's much more muted with Toby Hooper. I think there is some with John Carpenter, but John, that's a whole different kind of thing. But more specifically, yes, I think Cullen and Romero are equitable.
You know, and the other thing I would mention is Fuller. Fuller, of course, is better known for its war pictures, the steel helmet, you know, the big red one. But he really also, one of the great Fuller films that I love is White Dog, which is brutal, brutal film. And yeah. I think he was more brutal and more pointed in a specific thing that he wanted to attack, whereas Cohen is much more scattershot, and he'll you know, it's like a Magnum 44 versus a pellet gun, you know, but still the two of them hit it off really well, and that was one of the reasons, of course, that Fuller agreed to act in Salem's Lot, because he loved Cohen, and they were good friends. Now, well, after the stuff in It's Alive 3, which we've already talked about, then I think we get into, as far as his directing films, not, you know, he less and less came focused on directing. Though I think his Masters of Horror is really good. I also really like Original Gangsters, too. I like The Androns. It's not like I don't like those films, but I don't think they're as pointed as... Oh, I do, too. You want to talk a little bit about that before we go into some of his writing and that that he did with Lustig? So yeah, just talk a little bit about The Ambulance.
I just thought it was a lot of fun. I just thought it was kind of thrilling, a little bit unpredictable, very good kind of Hitchcockian film. It hits the ground running. It never lets up. It's kind of a unique blend of action, horror, and conspiracy thriller. I like that it has a nice feminist angle with the beat cop that cracks the case. And Eric Roberts is so fucking good in it. He's so good in it. He's so much fun. It's a great, great movie.
So
it's just a lot of, it's a joy to watch. I mean, it's just a whole lot of fun to watch.
Yeah. And I also like Eric Braeden in that film too, very, very much. I recommend it. And Original Gangsters, which he goes back into the blaxploitation, and he has everybody there, including Pam Grier, Ron O'Neill, and that. And he even has Robert Forster in a small role. They made up. That's a really fun film, too. I think that's a really fun film. And one of the nice things about that film is they shot that in Gary, Indiana. And he actually hired gang members from opposing gangs and made them work together. And during the production, there was no problem. Once production left and he left, and it went back to shit. But he showed that these people could work together. And I think that's something really, really prescient and really good to say about Larry. Now, as we finish up here, I wanted to get back and talk a little bit about his writing. And of course, you know, he wrote Phone Booth, which actually he had written for Hitchcock back in the 60s. Then revamped it, and they made it with Colin Farrell and Kiefer Sutherland. But before that, let's not forget his work with Bill Lustig. Now, unfortunately, they had a parting of the ways, unfortunately, and that's a shame. But, you know, the Maniac Cop series, I think, is one of the great series of all time, directed by Lustig. Certainly the first two, not so much Badge of Silence. But also written by Larry Cohen. And what do you think of those films, the Maniac Cop films?
I have not ever seen a Maniac Cop movie, sadly. I know it's shocking, but I've never seen any one of the three Maniac Cop films, nor have I seen Uncle Sam.
Okay.
No, that's not his.
Oh, yes, it is. Uncle Sam, I watch that every July 4th. That's the movie that actually broke.
Good?
I like it. It's not great, but I like it. I like it a lot.
I've always pulled the trigger on it a few times.
Well, you know, the thing about it is even his lesser films, you know, it's like Altman. There's lesser Altman, but there's always something interesting to watch in it. There's always something there.
All right.
And that's true of Altman, and that's true of Cohen. You know, so even lesser Cohen, you know, no problem. But, you know, I mean, if you go back, you know, we talked a little bit about his TV work. But there's a couple of films that he actually wrote. He wrote The Return of the Magnificent Seven, which I don't know if you've ever seen.
I have not.
Okay. He did the screenplay and story to Daddy's Gone Hunting, a very interesting film that was one of the first films that tackled abortion. He also did Scream Baby Scream. He did a number of things. He did another Western, which I've not seen, called El Condor. But he just did so much. And seriously, if you want to take a look at anything that he's done, you can tell. But there's one film I need to talk about before we go. And so how many of the Body Snatcher films have you seen?
I've seen three of the four.
Okay. So have you seen the 90s one, Body Snatcher? The one that
Absolutely.
Abel Ferrara directed? Okay.
Absolutely.
Now, do you know the story of that?
I know that Larry Cohen wrote a treatment for it. I thought he was attached to it, and then, you know, it ended up not happening, but, you know, he ended up retaining credit on there because they used the majority of that screenplay, or that
exactly. And not only that, Stuart Gordon and then of course was attached to it. And then of course, Abel Ferrara came in with Dennis St. John, his partner, and everybody said, "We ain't touching this. The idea is there." And the idea that Cohen came up was put it in a military base where you cannot tell basically who has been taken over or not, because they all act the same. And it's beautiful. And seriously,
yes,
out of all four of the films, and I don't really count the fourth one, which is called Invasion. That's the Nicole Kidman one. That one sucks. But of the three that use the name, the scariest scene of any of them is where Jennifer Tilly comes down completely nude and just goes, "Where are you going to go? Where are you going to hide? Where are you going to go?" It's like, I get fucking chills down the spine with that.
Yeah.
Seriously.
That's a great piece of acting. That's a great, great piece of acting. That, again, that's another one of those movies where it's another one of those performances that back in the day, you know, it's a genre piece. Nobody's paying any attention to it. And unfortunately, Body Snatchers did not do anything at the box office. But today, if that movie came out today with that performance in it, she'd be considered, you know, for a nomination, certainly. That her performance in that movie is what I remember most about that movie, and I love that movie. But I think her performance in that movie is exemplary, and it's creepy. I love the time of year that it's set in. It's very brown. You know, it's very, mm-hmm. you know, it's, what is it? It's like, no, like what, maybe January or something. I mean, it looks pretty dead. Everything's all sort of, but I actually love that movie. I prefer, my favorite version is the 78, the Philip Kaufman version. And I think it has pound for pound, probably the scariest moment, or the moment that takes my breath away every time, is the fucking dog with the man's face.
Yeah.
But I do think Abel Ferrara's Body Snatchers is an incredible film. But, you know, further than that, I also think Abel Ferrara is an incredible filmmaker. So I'm a huge Abel Ferrara fan. So there's that.
Well, we'll have to do an Abel Ferrara get together because I'm a big Ferrara fan too.
Absolutely.
But for me, I love the original. The original is iconic and always will be. Okay. But of all of the sequels and remakes of it, I'm really not a fan of the 70s one. I'm not. But Ferrara's, I think, is absolutely fucking amazing. And that's another film that I would recommend. And I will tell you this, that scene that I described with Jennifer Tilly, it has been said by both Gordon and Dennis St. John that was in the original script that Larry Cohen wrote. That scene.
Well, that's not surprising. I mean, he's a fabulous writer. That's the thing. I mean, he's such a great writer. You know, just really works.
You know, another movie that I do need to mention briefly, which I love, and I wonder if you had seen it, is Bestseller.
I knew you were going to ask me that. I've not seen Bestseller. It's one of those that I think a couple of years ago I went looking to buy it because I went through a phase where I just snatched up everything I could of Larry Cohen's, and it's one of those that he had written that I really wanted because also I'm a big Brian Dennehy fan and I like that era of James Woods. So, but sadly it was sort of out of my reach, and I think a Blu-ray has since come out of it, but I still haven't picked it up and seen it. But I know I know it's like right up my alley.
You are going to love it. You are going to love that movie. The writing is just so sharp. And John Flynn, who took the directorial views, he did Rolling Thunder. He's a very underrated director, and he does fantastic work here. Dennehy, this and Belly of the Architect, best roles by far. James Woods, one of his best roles. Everybody in this, Leslie Ann Down is in this. Even Seymour Cassell is in this for a short period of time. And James Remar is nasty as fuck. You know, I mean, it's a great film, and it's another film I would recommend, particularly for Cohen, because you could tell it's a Larry Cohen script. You can tell. You know, I mean, that's one thing about him as a writer. You know, not only as a director, but as a writer, you can tell who wrote, you know, And let's not forget, you know, he started with The Defenders. He did so much television work. And he did some of the best Columbos, too. He wrote three or four of the Columbos, including two with Patrick McGoohan. So, you know, I mean, seriously, this guy was one of the great writers, one of the great genre directors, and just a real hero of mine. Seriously. And I'm so glad that you're doing your series of essays. And I'll tell you what, if you ever really want to try to get published, I got a couple places you should get them off to. I think what you do as far as your essay series is really top notch, Patrick. And I just wanted to say that.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Carl. I appreciate that. And I'll take you up on that, because sure, what else am I doing? I'd love to be published.
Okay. I'll absolutely give you a couple people to talk to. So we were planning to do something next Wednesday, but you got a little invite and something that you're doing next Wednesday that definitely trumps what I had in mind. So tell us what you're doing next Wednesday.
So next Wednesday, Lloyd Kaufman is going to be in Oklahoma City premiering Shakespeare Shitstorm, which is the new film he directed for Troma. And they're going to be showing that down at Rodeo Cinema down at the Stockyard City in Oklahoma City. And I was asked to moderate the Q&A, the in-person Q&A with him after the movie. So that will be next Wednesday, which was supposed to be the podcast you and I were supposed to do. But between now and then, I'm going to be cramming as much trauma material as I can just to prep for the Q&A, because this is going to be my first Q&A I've ever done. So I'm half nervous and half excited to do this, but it's quite an opportunity, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, I you know, be on stage with Lloyd Kaufman, that trumps everything as far as I'm concerned. That is a great, great opportunity, and I wish you well, and we'll certainly have you back on. And by the way, whatever you want to talk about, all you have to do is message me, and we'll put it in. I got, as far as I'm concerned, your family, you're part of the group now, you know, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, thank you. I'll take you up on that, because, yeah.
Please do. I'm being serious.
I'm being serious, too. After I'm in a couple of weeks, I'm gonna, my schedule will be more open, and I'll definitely start throwing some stuff your way.
Okay, cool. So right now we're going to do a little bit of what we like to call housekeeping. And so tomorrow, Adam Ferenc is going to be doing Cathode Ray Emission, and they're going to be doing the films of Ernst Lubitsch. And that's going to be another knockdown, drag them out, 2 to 3 hour fantastic show. Adam really does a great job. And so you want to tune in for that. On Saturday, Rachel is off on vacation. She is on in Mississippi at the Gulf Wars. And she'll explain that when she comes back. But TC and I are going to be doing another nod to Women's History Month with a music show. And we're going to be featuring lesser known and undervalued female singers. And so we're going to be doing that on Saturday. On Sunday, TC has his own show, Rock This Town. And he'll be doing an hour show, usually about an hour and 15 minutes, of famous female performances. And he'll be doing that on Sunday. And then a week or on Wednesday, next Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, actually, we welcome back one of our favorite guests on Deviant Legion. We have author Danny Perry. Danny wrote the three series of cult movies books, Cult Movies, Cult Movies 2, Cult Movies 3. He's also written a lot of sports books. You want to follow him on Facebook because he has some of the best posts and some of the best quizzes. He's just a mountain of information. And Danny pitched this idea, and what we're going to do is we're going to celebrate the 80th anniversary of the release of Jacques Tourneur's and Val Lewton's Cat People in 1942, and we'll be focusing on the filmography of Val Lewton, including Body Snatchers and several other films. A fantastic filmmaker who really focused on suggesting horror as opposed to showing it. And the camera work, everything about Val Lewton's work is just phenomenal. This is stuff that I grew up watching when I was young on like Chiller Theater back in the 60s and very, very much part of my childhood. And so we're really happy to talk about Val Lewton. We're also really happy that Danny Perry is back with us because he's a phenomenal guest and you'll really like him. So I know you'll be with Lloyd Kaufman, but I'll be with Danny Perry and I'm okay with that. So.
Right. Well, I'm sorry to miss that because that was going to be a lot of fun. I had all my Val Lewton set out. I was getting ready to just devour all those and looking forward to that. But yeah, I had to, duty calls.
You've got to do the Lloyd Kaufman thing. Are you kidding? You got to do that. No doubt.
Right.
Patrick, I got to say, it's such a pleasure to have you back. And once your schedule frees up, you're always welcome to come back. You're always welcome to pitch things. Please do, because I think you are just phenomenal as a guest, and you're part of the family as far as I'm concerned. So there you go.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the very kind words. I appreciate them very much, Carl. And I love being on, and I love you too. You've done a lot for me, and I'm just always happy to be on.
Okay. So to everyone, I just want to say again, thanks for listening, and thanks for putting up with me and enjoying Patrick. And what we're going to do now is we're basically going to say good night. So, Patrick, again, thank you very much for being on. And at this point, we're just going to say good night.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Okay, and thank you very much for being with us. Good night.